Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. U.S. suspect found dead in Idaho shooting that killed two firefighters. Brush fire on Canfield Mountain in Coeur d'Alene set deliberately so sniper could ambush firefighters, authorities said, by Ginger Adams Otis and Paul Redkoff. Two firefighters were killed Sunday, and a third was wounded by a sniper who set a brush fire in a northern Idaho mountain park to ambush them, authorities said. The suspected shooter, a male, was found dead with a firearm nearby late Sunday after residents in the Canfield Mountain area of Coeur d'Alene endured a shelter-in-place order for most of the afternoon. The order was lifted shortly after the suspect was found. We believe there was only one shooter, Kootenai County Sheriff Bob Norris said late Sunday. We based it on the weapons we found on the scene. Roughly 300 law enforcement agents were involved in the manhunt. Gunfire was exchanged with the suspect, Norris said. Authorities were still waiting on a positive identification and weren't ready to discuss a motive, he said. This was a total ambush. These firefighters didn't have a chance, he said. The brush fire still wasn't under control as of late Sunday, according to officials. Firefighting crews responded to a fire in Canfield Mountain, just north of Coeur d'Alene, about 1:30 p.m. local time, Norris said. Gunshots rang out about half an hour later. Firefighters who responded to the bushfire were ordered to fall back and abandon the blaze. Governor Brad Little said multiple firefighting personnel were attacked. This is a heinous direct assault on our brave firefighters, Little said on X. The sniper was able to hide in the rocky landscape, Norris said. There is a belief that he ran and shot, he said. Authorities were able to pinpoint the suspect's location through technology that tracked a cell phone, he said. With the brush fire approaching and the suspect showing no movement, authorities rushed in to preserve as much evidence as possible, including the body, said Norris. The two firefighters who were fatally shot were from the Coeur d'Alene Fire Department and from the Kootenai County Fire and Rescue, the officials said. The wounded firefighter underwent surgery and was in stable condition Sunday night. Multiple agencies participated in the manhunt in the area before the suspect was found. Tactical assets and technical teams from the Federal Bureau of Investigation were on scene providing support, an FBI official said in a post on X. Special agents and certified fire investigators from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives offices in Seattle and Portland, Oregon were also at the scene, officials said. Canfield Mountain's 24-acre park, about 5 miles from Coeur d'Alene, is a popular area for hiking with an extensive trail system. Coeur d'Alene, a city of roughly 60,000, is located about 35 miles east of Spokane, Washington. Central banks. Trump's criticism of Fed's rate decisions not necessarily a threat to its independence, BIS says. Trump has repeatedly urged Powell to lower the Fed's key interest rate in order to lift growth. By Paul Hannon. Public calls for lower interest rates of the kind directed by President Trump toward Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell are not a threat to the central bank's independence, the Bank for International Settlements said Sunday. The Switzerland-based BIS is owned by most of the world's leading central banks, although not the Fed, and has long provided a forum to policymakers for sharing ideas and concerns. Over recent decades, the BIS has advocated for giving central banks freedom to set interest rates to meet the goals mandated by legislatures, which usually include keeping the inflation rate at a specified level or within a range. On a number of occasions, Trump has urged Powell to lower the Fed's key interest rate in order to lift growth. Earlier this month, he called on Powell to reduce the rate to between 1% and 2% from 4.3% in order to contain the rising costs of servicing the government's debts. While the BIS said in an annual report that doubts have been raised about the administration's commitment to central bank independence, it judged that comments of the kind made by Trump don't represent a threat to the federal autonomy. As long as society supports an institution with a mandate to preserve stability It should not be a threat, said Augustin Carstens, general manager of the BIS and a former governor of Mexico's central bank. Despite Trump's criticisms of the Fed's policy decisions, opinion polls suggest a majority of voters continued to back its independence in setting interest rates. A mid-April survey of 4,941 U.S. adults by YouGov found that 57% supported the Fed's independence, while just 14% wanted to see it removed. However, 29% were undecided. Carstens said that disagreements between governments and central banks are almost by design, since the power to set interest rates is delegated to a central bank precisely because it will be willing to take decisions that a government would not. It shouldn't necessarily surprise us that there will be, from time to time, tensions, because what society has said is this institution should do what it deems necessary to protect the value of the currency, and oftentimes what needs to be done doesn't match with what governments may want to see, he said. The BIS repeated its view that the independence of central banks is essential if they are to succeed in protecting the value of money, and warned that failure to perform that task can have serious consequences. We have had quite substantial episodes where monetary policy mismanagement has led to devastating effects on inflation, affecting the well-being of individuals and firms, sometimes bringing countries to a brink, Carstens said. In its annual report on the global economic outlook, the BIS said the prospects for growth have been weakened by the unpredictability that the Trump administration has brought to policymaking, in addition to the new barriers to trade that tariffs represent. Beyond the policy measures themselves, the repeated cycle of announcements, adjustments, and reversals has fostered an atmosphere of uncertainty and volatility, compounding the challenges for the global economy, the BIS said. The BIS said the fragmentation of the global economy wrought by higher tariffs would likely increase the frequency of inflation surges, such as those that occurred in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. As supply chains adjust, there is the potential for significant disruptions to trade and temporary shortages of some goods, the BIS said. As witnessed during the pandemic, such disruptions can have significant and long-lasting ramifications for production and prices across the economy. On to our next story. Economy. China PMI signals continued decline in manufacturing. The official Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index for June came in at 49.7. China's manufacturing activity declined for the third straight month in June as trade frictions with the U.S. continued to weigh on the world's second largest economy. The official Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index for June, the first full month after the China-U.S. trade truce was reached in London, came in at 49.7, edging up from May's 49.5 and matching the 49.7 tipped by a Wall Street Journal poll of economists, according to data released by the National Bureau of Statistics on Monday. A reading above 50 suggests an expansion in manufacturing, while a reading below that suggests a contraction. Monday's print followed a run data suggesting the Chinese economy had lost some momentum in May amid the remaining U.S. tariffs slapped on Chinese goods despite the trade detente. Still, economists say Chinese policymakers seem satisfied with the economy's performance so far this year. Chinese Premier Li Qiang last week said that economic indicators continued to improve in the second quarter despite external challenges. Also, China's central bank has also adopted a less dovish policy tone, according to Goldman Sachs economists in a recent report. We think the upcoming July Politburo meeting is unlikely to announce major stimulus and additional easing measures should be targeted, e.g. focusing on labor and property markets, rather than broad-based, the Goldman economist said. Other sub-indexes released Monday showcased mild improvements. The production sub-index increased to 51.0 in June from 50.7 in May, the subindex for total new orders moved back to the expansionary territory and climbed to 50.2 in June, compared with 49.8 in May, and the new export orders subindex rose to 49.7 from 47.5. China's non-manufacturing PMI, which covers both service and construction activity, edged up to 50.5 in June from 50.3 in May, said the Statistics Bureau. Noting the signs of improvement in June, Zixuan Wang, an economist at Capital Economics, remained cautious about China's economic outlook, citing weaker export growth and a fading fiscal tailwind that is likely to slow activity later this year. Economists say eventually Beijing will need more aggressive stimulus to secure its official annual goal for around 5% economic growth as policymakers grapple with a protracted property slump and a bleak labor market. Americas. Canada rescinds digital services tax to salvage trade discussions with U.S. Carney Trump will try to reach an agreement by July 21, Canadian spokeswoman says, by Vipal Manga in Toronto and Paul Vieira in Ottawa. Canada announced late on Sunday that it is rescinding a digital services tax in a bid to salvage trade discussions with the U.S. after President Trump paused talks on Friday. Canada's finance department was set to collect billions of dollars from U.S. tech companies starting on Monday when payments were due under a digital services tax that Canada's Liberal government implemented last year under former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. On Sunday, the government announced it would pause collections and introduce legislation in Parliament to rescind the tax in anticipation of a mutually beneficial comprehensive trade arrangement with the United States. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney spoke with Trump on Sunday, said a spokeswoman for the Prime Minister's office. The two leaders decided to move forward with trade discussions with the goal of reaching agreement by July 21. The White House didn't immediately respond for comment. In an interview with Fox News broadcast earlier on Sunday, Trump complained about certain taxes that Canada had imposed. "People don't realize Canada is very nasty to deal with," he said. Canada's move comes 2 days after Trump announced that he had terminated trade talks with Canada over what he called an egregious tax that unfairly targeted U.S. tech companies. Canada's 3% tax on technology companies' revenue from providing digital services to Canadian users or sales of Canadian user data was retroactive to revenue dating to 2022 and fueled opposition from America's biggest tech companies, Washington-based lobby groups, senior congressional leaders, and officials in both the Biden and Trump administrations. On June 19th, despite the U.S.'s opposition, Finance Ministers François-Philippe Champagne said Canada would remain firm on keeping the digital service tax. That refusal to back down incensed Trump, according to a senior U.S. official. He gave no warning to Carney before he blasted the decision on Truth Social. "Based on this egregious tax, we are hereby terminating all discussions on trade with Canada, effective immediately," Trump wrote Friday. On Sunday, the Canadian Finance Department said in a statement that it had enacted the tax as a stopgap while it worked with other countries, including the U.S., to replace national digital services taxes. Canada's preference has always been a multilateral agreement related to digital services taxation, said the statement. Trump said in the Oval Office last Friday that the U.S. held all the cards in its talks with Canada on a new economic and security pact between the two countries. "About one-fifth of the country's economic output depends on trade with the U.S., and recent economic data suggests that Canada's gross domestic product likely contracted in the second quarter, with the risk of another decline in the third quarter, because of elevated trade uncertainty and a sharp drop in exports to the U.S. Carney has been trying to get a trade agreement with the U.S. to lift 50% tariffs on steel and aluminum, as well as duties on cars made in Canada and on imports that aren't compliant with the U.S.-Mexico to Canada trade agreement. The American Chamber of Commerce in Canada applauded Carney's decision to drop the digital tax. We commend the Canadian government for choosing a path that prioritizes dialogue and progress, said the Chamber's Chief Executive Rick Tuchuk. Michael Geist, an internet law expert at the University of Ottawa's Law School, said Canadian officials had ignored warnings from Washington dating back to 2023 about economic repercussions from pursuing a digital services tax. Both the Biden and Trump administrations argued the digital tax was targeted mostly at U.S. companies. Hard to imagine this could have been handled in a worse way, Geist said about Ottawa's decision to scrap the digital tax. Economy. Japan factory output rose in May, but tariffs cloud outlook. Industrial production rose 0.5% in May after declining 1.1% in April, by Megumi Fukuyawa. Japan's industrial production increased modestly in May, but the rebound is likely to be temporary due to the impact of U.S. tariffs and concerns over a global slowdown. Industrial production rose 0.5% in May from the previous month after declining 1.1% in April. Data released by the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry showed on Monday. The May reading was much weaker than the 3.5% increase expected in a poll of economists by data provider Quick. Production is expected to slow in the coming months as President Trump's tariffs weigh on exports and Japanese firms become cautious about their capital spending. Companies expect output to rise 0.3% in June and decrease 0.7% in July, the government data showed. Although capital expenditure continue to recover, supported by strong corporate profits, increasing uncertainty surrounding U.S. tariff policy is expected to make companies more cautious in their investment behavior going forward, said NLI Research Institute economist Taro Saito. Saito said that corporate profits, especially of automakers, are likely to be hit hard as businesses try to absorb higher duties by cutting product prices. Some major Japanese companies have already given weak profit projections for the current business year. Despite the expected significant impact on the Japanese economy, it remains unclear if Tokyo will be able to close a trade deal with the U.S. before a pause on so-called reciprocal tariffs expires in early July. While the White House has said Trump could extend the grace period, many analysts reckon it will be difficult for Japan to win a complete exemption from additional tariffs. In an interview aired Sunday, Trump called the auto trade between the U.S. and Japan unfair, saying the U.S. buys millions of Japanese cars, but Japan won't take American ones. Saying the letters would be sent to countries to determine trade deals, Trump said, "I could send one to Japan. Dear Mr. Japan, here's the story. You're going to pay a 25% tariff on your cars." Citing the report, Japan's top negotiator, Ryosuke Akazawa, said in a social media post on Monday that the two countries have agreed to continue trade talks and that discussions have reached a critical juncture. Credit Agricole analysts expect the Bank of Japan to maintain monetary policy steady throughout the year due to the tariff concerns. As the BOJ believes the pace of growth will slow due to the impact of trade policies, there's no longer a rush to raise interest rates, they said, adding that fading expectations for early monetary tightening have helped buoy Tokyo stocks. The Nikkei stock average was up 1.6% on Monday. Middle East. How Israel killed Iran's top nuclear scientists. Targeted attacks showed intelligence prowess and took out a layer of leaders, but a new generation could blunt the impact, by Lawrence Norman and Dov Lieber. When Israel's attacks on Iran began before dawn on June 13th, explosions shattered the homes of some of Iran's top scientists, killing nine people who had worked for decades on Tehran's nuclear program. All nine were killed in near simultaneous attacks to prevent them from going into hiding, according to people familiar with the attacks. 11 days later, hours before a ceasefire brokered by the U.S. and Qatar took effect Wednesday, an attack in northern Iran killed another scientist, Saeed Sedigigi Saber, according to Israeli and Iranian state media. He was sanctioned just weeks ago by the U.S. for his nuclear weapons-related work. The attack on the scientist was considered so fantastical by even its planners that it was called Operation Narnia after the fictional C.S. Lewis series. The killings were the culmination of 15 years of efforts to wipe out one of Iran's most prized assets, the top cadre of scientists who worked on a secret nuclear weapons-related program that Iran had pursued at least until 2003. Israel had closely tracked the scientists ever since. While the U.S. and Israel are trying to assess the extent of damage done by their strikes on Iran's main nuclear site, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has claimed that the killings have pushed back Iran's nuclear program by years. Former officials and experts say the attacks against the scientists delivered a powerful blow against Iran's ability to race for the bomb in the aftermath of the conflict. Most of the people killed, a total of at least 11 by the time a ceasefire took effect Wednesday, had hands-on experience in testing and building components of a warhead, like the detonation systems, high explosives, and the neutron sources that trigger the chain reaction. It's one thing to lose that expertise slowly over time, especially if you are not trying to actually build a bomb. You have time to replace them, said Eric Brewer, who was U.S. National Security Director to Counterproliferation. But if you're in the middle of trying to build a bomb, or if you see that as a potential near-term option, then it's going to have a bigger impact. Iran has retained and passed a lot of that expertise onto a new generation of scientists. It has denied ever having sought the bomb, saying its program is peaceful. The UN Atomic Agency said Iran had a nuclear weapons-related program known as the Ahmad Project until 2003. Israeli and Western officials say that Iran's nuclear weapons work has continued in a more fragmented way since then, leaving Iran within months of being able to build a bomb. But much of that work has been confined to studies and computer modeling, always carefully designed to be explained away as conventional military work. A week after the June 13th attacks, Israel used a drone to kill another scientist who was being kept in what was supposed to be a safe house in Tehran. That person hasn't been named. Israel also said last week it had bombed the Tehran headquarters of the SPND, the successor organization of Ahmad. The deadly airstrikes were the first to target Iran's nuclear scientists since 2020, when Mohsen Farizadeh was gunned down with a remote control weapon. Israel has never denied or confirmed its roles in the deaths of five Iranian scientists between 2010 and 2020. On Saturday, thousands attended the funerals of the scientists and other prominent Iranians killed during the conflict, Iranian state media said. Some of the coffins carried family members of the scientists, the semi-official Fars News agency reported. Israel hasn't commented on whether family members were also killed in the strikes targeting the scientists. Israel said its actions have stopped Iran from crossing the threshold to having a nuclear weapon. Among the most important targets was Feridun Abbasi Devani, the former head of the Atomic Agency of Iran and one of the founders of Iran's nuclear weapons-related work, according to David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security. Abbasi Devani was a manager and senior advisor of the Ahmad program, with his scientific work focusing on the development of neutron initiators, which fire neutrons into the core of a weapon to trigger a chain reaction. Abbasi Devani survived a car bomb assassination attempt in 2010, on the same day another Iranian nuclear scientist was killed. In a recent TV interview, Abbasi Devani said Iran had all the knowledge it needed for a nuclear weapon. "If they tell me to build a bomb, I will build it," he said. Another killed scientist was Mohammad Mehdi Taranchi, who led a unit under Farizadeh focusing on high explosives, which are needed to detonate a nuclear weapon, according to the U.S. Treasury Department. He later became a professor at the physics department of Tehran's prestigious Shahid Beheshti University, where a large number of nuclear scientists, including Abbasi Devani, worked, said Ronan Solomon, an Israel security analyst. One of the last targets, Said Sedigai Saber, was head of the Ki Shahid Karimi Group, which runs explosives-related projects for the SPND program. A spokeswoman for the Israeli military declined to name the person killed. Sedigai Saber is linked to projects including research and testing applicable to the Department of Nuclear Explosives Devices, the U.S. Treasury Department said when it sanctioned him on May 12th. Abbasi Devani and Tarachi were also sanctioned by the U.S. along with others for their nuclear-related work. So was Shahid Beheshti University. Andrea Stricker, a fellow university at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a Washington think tank, said Israel's targeted killings took out the brain trust of nuclear scientists and dealt a blow to Iran's ability to draw on people who have past and possibly ongoing experience in constructing specific components of nuclear weapons. Yet others describe a sophisticated system Iran had developed for retaining and advancing its nuclear weapons expertise. That system has allowed Iran's nuclear program to advance even as its top scientists were being killed. Iran has for years maintained a nuclear archive detailing all the work it had carried out before 2003, as well as Tehran's future plans. It was discovered and raided by Israeli commandos in 2018. Iran kept old nuclear weapons-related equipment, including undeclared enriched uranium, just down the road from the archive. It was dispersed in 2018, and the UN Atomic Energy Agency has been demanding answers ever since to where it was sent. Iran has used universities like Shahid Beheshti, the Sharif University of Technology, and Malik Ashtar University to keep alive its nuclear weapons expertise over the past two decades, Solomon said. At these universities, Iran often matches up its nuclear scientists on experiments and other studies with younger students, Solomon said. Two of the scientists killed on June 13, Madreza Zulfagari and Abdulhamid Minocher, published an article in the Annals of Nuclear Energy in June 2024 that used advanced computer modeling to show how neutron sources behave in a chain reaction, he said. That information can be used for civilian purposes, like building a nuclear reactor or to help trigger a chain reaction in a nuclear weapon. There are professors and they are teaching the younger scientists to enter the heart of the Iranian nuclear program, Solomon said. Opinion: Trump puts the Senate in play in 2026. By helping drive Tom Tillis into retirement, he puts his presidency at risk, by the editorial board. A common feature of Donald Trump's two terms as president is that he can't stand political prosperity. When events are going in his direction, he has an uncanny habit of handing his opponents a sword. The latest example came Sunday after GOP leaders dragged several holdouts across the line to vote A and start debate over the Senate version of the budget reconciliation bill. The vote was 51-49, but Mr. Trump couldn't leave victory alone. Instead, he unloaded on the two GOP dissenters, Rand Paul of Kentucky and especially Tom Tillis of North Carolina. Mr. Trump dumped three different Truth Social posts on Mr. Tillis, calling him a sellout, a talker and complainer, and various other insults. He also all but promised to support a Republican opponent in the GOP primary for Senate in 2026 when Mr. Tillis' term ends. Numerous people have come forward wanting to run in the primary against Senator Tom Tillis, Mr. Trump said on Truth Social. I will be meeting with them over the coming weeks, looking for someone who will properly represent the great people of North Carolina. Mr. Tillis promptly said he won't run for re-election. Even if Mr. Tillis had already been contemplating retirement, His withdrawal opens a seat that is another pickup opportunity for Democrats next year. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. The GOP has a 53-47 majority now, but Susan Collins always has a tough race in Maine if she decides to run again. Democrats are targeting Joni Ernst in Iowa. In the Suicide Isn't Painless department, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is challenging GOP incumbent Senator John Cornyn. Mr. Paxton may be the only Republican who could lose in Texas, given his record harassing businesses with lawsuits, impeachment, and other embarrassments. The GOP pickup opportunities are few, so with Mr. Tillis's departure in the Senate is in play for 2026. Oh, and on Sunday, GOP Representative Don Bacon said he won't run for re-election in his swing Omaha seat. That's a likely game for Democrats in the House. Mr. Tillis and Bacon didn't help themselves by echoing Democratic attacks against the GOP's very modest Medicaid changes. But then Mr. Trump and GOP leaders haven't helped them or the party by failing to make the moral and fiscal case for those reforms. GOP legislative reforms will have no chance if Democrats take the House in 2026. And if they also take the Senate, forget about confirming another Supreme Court nominee. The Trump presidency will be dead in the water. Russia amasses 50,000 troops around Sumy, putting Ukraine in precarious position. Holding the Russians off has become a game of whack-a-mole for outnumbered Ukrainian troops, with Russia frequently opening new lines of attack, by Ian Lovett and Nikita Nikolienko. Russian forces are just 12 miles from this northern Ukrainian regional capital, a new target for Moscow as the Kremlin presses its manpower advantage at a growing number of places along the front. Having almost entirely ejected Ukrainian forces from the Russian Kursk region earlier this year, Russian forces have now poured over the border in the opposite direction towards Sumy. With 50,000 troops in the area, they outnumber the Ukrainians roughly 3-1, according to soldiers fighting there. Their main strategy, General Alexander Syrsky, Russia's top military commander, said of the Russians, is to wear us down with their numbers. The Russian advance towards Sumy comes as President Trump has begun voicing growing frustration with the Kremlin's unwillingness to broker a ceasefire. Though meetings between Ukrainian and Russian officials have continued in Turkey throughout recent weeks, Moscow has stepped up its missile and drone attacks on Ukrainian cities during the same period. Overnight on Sunday, Ukraine lost an F-16 jet fighter and its pilot during an aerial bombardment, the largest since the start of the war in terms of numbers of munitions launched. Over the past year, the front line has grown by more than 100 miles, Syrsky said, and now stretches more than 750 miles in an arc from the northeast to the south. The Russians have been probing in different spots across the line and then pushing hard when they find one that gives, as they did in Sumy last month. That leaves Ukrainian commanders playing whack-a-mole, sending in elite units to help plug gaps. Earlier this month, Ukraine sent elite commando units from its military intelligence directorate, known as HUR, to help stabilize the situation. Since then, the Russian advances in Sumy have been largely stopped, and Ukraine has clawed back some territory. Now we're looking for ways to conduct our own assaults and push the enemy back, said Timur, commander of the Timur Special Forces Unit, an elite unit of HUR that has been fighting in the region for several weeks. It isn't an easy task for Ukrainian forces, which are outnumbered nearly everywhere across the front. Their numbers are a big problem for us, though not enough to outrun us, said Kappa, commander of the Chimera unit of the Timur Special Forces Unit. The enemy is losing 300 to 400 people per day across the region. But they can deal with that level of casualties. They keep bringing in reserves. Earlier this month, a team of about a dozen men from the Timur Special Forces Unit set out for an assault on a Russian-held village north of Sumy. But as they reached a trench in a tree line about halfway to the village, they ran into a Russian assault team coming from the other direction. For the next 7 hours, they found themselves pinned in the trench as the Russians, who significantly outnumbered them, tried to surround them. "It was the cruelest fight I've ever been in," said Mark, the Ukrainian team's 25-year-old platoon commander. "They were attacking with infantry, drones, grenade launchers, machine guns, artillery, cluster munitions, everything. We never had more than a 5-minute break while they were regrouping." Mark said his team killed 5 Russians during the fight, which would often prompt a platoon to retreat. But he said the Russian troops were better trained than others he has come up against. They kept pushing forward to take the trench. Videos of the fight from the soldiers' helmet cameras, which were viewed by the Wall Street Journal, show a near-constant barrage with gunfire sounding like corn popping. Mark calls in mortar strikes and frequently presses himself against the edge of the trench as he hears the whistle of artillery approaching. The team's machine gunner fired 5,500 rounds during the fight. Eventually, they decide to pull back, climbing back through the branches and shrubs while mortars and attack drones hit around them. The entire team made it back, though three sustained non-fatal gunshot wounds. The whole team suffered concussions. "I'm really glad we got everyone out alive," Mark said. "We were in a really tough situation." Still, soldiers in the area say that holding Sumy is coming at a greater human cost than necessary. During the half year that Ukraine held territory in Russia's Kursk region, soldiers who fought there said they assumed the military would be preparing strong defensive positions on the Ukrainian side of the border. Instead, after a chaotic and costly retreat from Kursk, they found outdated trenches with no overhead cover from drones. The soldiers are now digging their own positions under drone fire in some cases. They also complain that areas that the Russians are now advancing across weren't mined. "It's like they prepared for tank columns, not a battlefield where dozens of drones strike daily," said one infantry commander named Krylo, who fought in Kursk and is now fighting in Sumy. "Every single day a position isn't ready is a day someone might not come back." Asked about fortifications last week, Defense Minister Rustem Umerov said that the defensive lines in Sumy were being improved in threatened areas. "Fortification is not just about concrete and trenches. It is an adaptive engineering system that takes the enemy's tactics into account and always serves one purpose: protecting our warriors." Policy: Republicans fight it out on Trump's tax megabill. Splits in Senate GOP on Medicaid and deficits strain efforts to quickly pass legislation. By Jasmine Lee and Richard Rubin. The Senate geared up for an unpredictable battle Monday over final passage of the GOP's Big Beautiful Bill, after Republicans narrowly advanced the measure in a 51-49 weekend vote. The 940-page legislation is driving a wedge between the GOP's two wings, just as the party is racing to pass the measure this week. Centrists have raised concerns about cutting benefit programs and straining state budgets, while fiscal conservatives are pushing for even more cuts to rein in federal budget deficits. Proponents maintain that the opportunity to pass President Trump's core agenda items and pressure from Trump on holdouts would propel the package over the finish line in the Senate, where the GOP has a 53-47 majority. "It's a big, beautiful bill if you believe in cutting people's taxes, securing the border, having a strong military, and controlling government spending," Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican South Carolina, said on the Senate floor Sunday. "The bottom line is we're about to make history," he said. A Senate votorama on the GOP's Big Beautiful Bill was scheduled to begin Monday morning, in which lawmakers can propose unlimited amendments, leading to hours of expected votes. Broadly, the mega bill would extend tax cuts and boost defense and border funding while cutting spending on Medicaid and food aid. It would add nearly $3.3 trillion to deficits compared with current law, and letting tax cuts expire as scheduled, according to the Congressional Budget Office. If the Senate manages to pass the bill, getting the measure to Trump by Republicans' self-imposed July 4th deadline would require another vote from the House. That might be challenging in that chamber as well, where Republicans have a narrow 220-212 majority, and their initial version of the bill passed by just one vote last month. Democrats are united against the measure, saying it cuts the social safety net to fund tax relief for the wealthy. Moderate House GOP lawmakers such as Representative David Velotto, Republican California, are also warning about Medicaid cuts. Others are expected to object because the bill increases deficits by nearly $500 billion more than the House Republicans previously said they could accept. Strains in the Senate. The initial procedural vote late Saturday showed the strains in the Senate. The vote was kept open for more than 3 hours as several Republican senators negotiated with party leaders before supporting the step forward. Senators Rand Paul, Republican Kentucky, and Tom Tillis, Republican North Carolina, bucked their party to vote against the motion to proceed. Tillis said Sunday he wouldn't run for re-election in 2026 after Trump criticized him in several Truth Social posts and said he would encourage potential primary challengers. On the Senate floor Sunday, Paul criticized a proposal in the bill to raise the debt limit by $5 trillion. That is an admission that they know they aren't controlling the deficit, he said. They know that the ensuing years will add trillions more. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who has called for protecting clean energy tax credits, spoke on the Senate floor on Saturday night with Finance Committee Chairman Mike Crapo, Republican Idaho, before voting to advance the measure. Vice President J.D. Vance huddled in the Capitol on Saturday night with a block of fiscal conservatives seeking spending cuts. Senators Rick Scott of Florida, Mike Lee of Utah, and Cynthia Lummis of Wyoming ultimately voted yes. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin flipped his no vote to a yes after speaking with Vance. Johnson told reporters afterwards that Trump and Senate GOP leadership would advocate for Scott's amendment to reduce the federal medical assistance percentage for new enrollment in Medicaid expansion states. But if they push too far, they risk losing support from moderates who have expressed concern over cuts to Medicaid. Another wrinkle surfaced early Sunday. The Senate parliamentarian advised lawmakers that they might need to strip two provisions that would have enhanced Alaska and Hawaii's Medicaid budgets after finding them to be in violation of reconciliation rules. The Senate bill included some carve-outs for Alaska, which could have sweetened the deal for moderate holdout Murkowski. Trump makes calls. Trump golfed with senators Saturday morning and made phone calls about the bill later that day, according to a person familiar with the matter. He took to Truth Social to bash Tillis and Paul for voting with Democrats against the procedural step late Saturday. On Sunday, Trump urged fiscal hawks not to go too crazy. For all cost-cutting Republicans, of which I am one, remember you still have to get reelected, he wrote on Truth Social. Instead of the regular CBO score, senators are instead assuming that all the expiring tax cuts are extended at no cost. That lets them claim that the bill doesn't increase deficits beyond 2034, an assertion that is essential to making the tax cuts permanent under Senate rules. Democrats attempted to get the Senate parliamentarians' advice on whether that maneuver complies with the law that limits what bills can use the fast-track budget reconciliation process. Republicans refused to have a bipartisan meeting with the parliamentarian, citing a portion of budget law that lets Senate Budget Committee Chairman Graham determine the numbers. Republicans have said they won't overrule the parliamentarian. In this case, they aren't getting her advice. On Sunday afternoon, the Senate floor was held by clerks who began reading the 940-page bill in its entirety at 11:08 p.m. Saturday at the request of Democrats. The reading wrapped up shortly after 3 p.m. If Senate Republicans won't tell the American people what's in this bill, then Democrats are going to force the chamber to read it from start to finish, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat New York, said. Wellness. Is your brain aging faster than you? New science offers clues. Emerging research on lifestyle changes and the development of preventative approaches are revealing an opportunity to measure and boost cognitive health. by Alex Janin. Dan Jones liked his job as a quality control inspector and loved his hobby even more, playing in a local bagpipe band. Then he started making mistakes in the pieces he played. He found himself having to write tasks down if he wanted to remember them. In 2021, at age 56, he was diagnosed with dementia. The future he had plotted with his wife, Darla, suddenly seemed to evaporate. "We had lots of plans, and they all ended," he said. Jones packed up his bagpipes for good and moved to a work role that offered a more predictable schedule. Then his wife learned about a study testing whether lifestyle changes could reverse early-stage Alzheimer's disease. Enrolling meant Jones had to give up his favorite foods like roast beef, homemade spaghetti and ice cream for a plant-based diet with minimally processed foods that are low in refined carbs and sugar. He had to do more exercise, meditate daily, and meet regularly with a support group. Several months into the study, Jones picked up his bagpipes again, and by July 2022, he was performing in a parade in his hometown of Cedar City, Utah. He had stopped waking up confused about where he was and traveling. Cognitive assessments showed that aspects of his memory had stabilized or improved. "You could not pay me to quit eating the way I eat now or to quit doing the exercise," he says. "It made that big of a difference." Jones wasn't alone. The full study, published in 2024 and led by the nonprofit Preventative Medicine Research Institute, found that brain function and cognition significantly improved in patients who made lifestyle changes. As tools and tests that gauge brain health become more accessible, a growing body of research suggests we can actually do something about it. The research comes as the gap widens between lifespan and health span, the number of years spent in good health. Americans are living longer on average, leaving more time to develop age-related diseases, including dementia. New cases of dementia will double by 2060 to roughly 1 million annually, according to a recent study. Dr. Dean Ornish, founder of the Preventative Medicine Research Institute, spent decades testing whether and how lifestyle changes could affect other diseases such as prostate cancer, heart disease, and aspects of aging itself. For the Alzheimer's study that included Jones, Ornish and a team of researchers randomly assigned 51 participants to one of two groups, a control group with no lifestyle changes or an intensive program. Patients were tested at baseline and retested after 4.5 months. In a test measuring changes in brain function over time, 71% of patients who made lifestyle changes showed improvement or no deterioration in their condition. In the control group, none improved and 68% got worse. The study's small sample size makes the findings difficult to generalize, according to Ornish, but the results show a big difference. The earlier you intervene, the less intensive the lifestyle changes likely need to be to prevent it, Ornish said. It's really giving new hope and new choices to people who didn't have that before. A separate study published in 2024 looked at healthy people. It found that even modest levels of physical activity, as low as 25 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity a week, are linked to bigger brain sizes, a marker for better brain health. "Lifestyle matters," said Rudolf Tanzi, a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and director of the McCants Center for Brain Health at Massachusetts General Hospital, who studies Alzheimer's disease genes and worked on the study, including Jones. "Advances in diagnostic and prognostic tools are helping doctors and scientists gain new understanding of how to measure and modify cognitive function." Adrain Irami, an associate professor at USC Leonard Davis School of Gerontology, who has studied brain aging for more than a decade, co-developed an artificial intelligence model that uses MRI scans to calculate how fast a patient's brain is aging relative to chronological age. The model takes into account variables linked to brain aging, such as the size of the hippocampus, which is involved in memory, and the thickness of the cortex, the brain's outermost layer. Irami said the model can monitor in real time how the brain reacts to problems or improvements in lifestyle. Faster brain aging is linked to a higher risk of cognitive impairment, he says. In May, the Food and Drug Administration approved the first blood test to help diagnose Alzheimer's disease. It is designed for people who are already having memory problems, not healthy people without symptoms. Various companies are developing blood tests that would let anyone determine brain age. NeurAge Therapeutics, a longevity biotech company, makes a $700 blood test that tracks dozens of RNA molecules. A more expensive package includes a blood test, a brain MRI, genetic testing, memory games, and analysis that offers a comprehensive brain age score. NeurAge was founded by Dr. Christian Glorioso, a neuroscientist. Glorioso carries one copy of the APOE4 gene, which carries an elevated risk of developing Alzheimer's. And she says she started putting a priority on sleep after seeing her results. There is a link between insufficient sleep and dementia risk. Many doctors and researchers say biological age testing requires rigorous research and validation before it should be widely adopted. It is also expensive. Many of the blood tests cost hundreds of dollars out of pocket, and elective MRIs can cost hundreds to thousands. I would be extremely cautious as a consumer, and I would want to see scientific evidence that whatever they measure is relevant, says Tony Weiss-Corey, a professor of neurology at Stanford University. His lab has developed a protein-based blood test to measure the ages of the brain and other organ systems. With refinement, these tools could one day make a big difference for patients like Dan Jones. The people who can know these things sooner have an advantage, said Jones, who adds that he didn't take any genetic or brain health specific tests before his diagnosis. I would have made the changes a lot earlier. In the study led by the Preventive Medicine Research Institute, some participants adopted these practices. Diet, a whole foods diet, minimally processed vegan diet, low in harmful fats, refined carbs, and sweeteners. Meals, along with certain nutritional supplements, were provided to the participants. Exercise, at least 30 minutes daily of moderate aerobic exercise and mild strength training, at least 3 times a week with personalized recommendations for participants. Stress management, 1 hour a day of techniques, including meditation, stretching, and breathing exercise, overseen by a certified stress management specialist. Adequate sleep was encouraged. Support, participants and their partners or spouses attended 1 hour support group sessions 3 times a week, focusing on emotional support. There were lectures on lifestyle as well as memory classes. Commodities and futures. Oil falls amid abating Middle East tensions. Oil falls in the early Asian session amid abating Middle East tensions, which typically reduces the probability of supply disruptions. The ceasefire between Iran and Israel, while fragile, has held so far, Saxo Bank's Ole Hansen said in a commentary. With geopolitical fears fading, traders have refocused on market fundamentals, which continue to point to ample supply into the second half of the year, the head of commodity strategy says. Production increases from a group of 8 OPEC Plus members are adding to the bearish narrative, Hansen says. Front month WTI crude oil futures are down 1.0% at 64.85 barrels. Front month Brent crude oil futures are 0.9% lower at $67.18 per barrel. Policy. Senate megabill stuns the clean energy industry with new tax on wind and solar. Elon Musk calls the Senate's latest version of the spending bill utterly insane and destructive, by Jennifer Hiller. Senate Republicans stunned the power industry over the weekend with a proposed new tax on wind and solar projects, part of a broader push to unravel incentives for renewable energy. Energy tax credits that were expanded during the Biden administration are wrapped up in a fierce congressional fight over President Trump's signature tax and spending bill. Most of the credits are now on the chopping block while lawmakers fight over ways to extend tax cuts and fund border and military spending, among other things. With each version of the bill to come out of Congress, the outlooks for the renewables industry looks bleak in new ways, industry players say. This weekend, clean energy companies were surprised by the sudden appearance of a tax that hadn't realized was under consideration. It would apply to wind and solar projects completed after 2027 if they use a certain percentage of components from China, the industry's primary supplier of everything from critical minerals to batteries. At a basic level, it is a fundamental break in the compact between Congress and the private sector, says Jason Grummet, chief executive of the American Clean Power Association, an industry group. It is truly unprecedented for Congress to design a punitive tax targeting one aspect of the American economy. Elon Musk, whose relationship as a key advisor to the president recently unraveled, called the Senate's latest version of the bill utterly insane and destructive on social media. It gives handouts to industries of the past while severely damaging industries of the future, said Musk, CEO of electric car maker Tesla. Wind and solar projects would qualify for tax credits only if placed in service by the end of 2027. The prior version of the bill allowed projects to qualify based on their construction start date. The new guidelines present a much tougher bar to clear. Developers can control construction starts, for instance, by ordering key equipment or building roads on a site. They have far less influence over in-service dates, which depend on being able to connect to the grid, where lines are long. Neil Bradley, Executive Vice President of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, called it a strong pro-growth bill on X, but added, "That said, taxing energy production is never good policy, whether oil and gas or, in this case, renewables. Electricity demand is set to see enormous growth, and this tax will increase prices. It should be removed." The power industry is grappling with meeting electricity demand that is rising for the first time in a generation. The growth is largely due to the artificial intelligence craze and rush to build huge electricity-chugging data centers. Developers argue that renewables will meet the rising demand because they account for most of the near-term electricity generation in the works. The Trump administration, on the other hand, wants to see more 24/7 power generation built. Yet there is a backlog of 4 to 5 years for natural gas power plant equipment, making it difficult to add many more of those plants quickly. The Senate bill also would end tax credits for the purchase of electric vehicles after September, quicker than the House's proposals call for eliminating them by the end of the year for most vehicles. Musk stands to lose because many of Tesla's customers claim tax credits for EVs, solar panels, and home battery systems, and Tesla benefits from battery storage tax credits. And that's all we have time for today. This brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting program on Sun Sounds.